We're back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Fleet Matthews Radio Show. Thank you for tuning in and listening wherever you are around the world and in the world. Dr. Jacqueline Battalore is back with me. She is an attorney and professor of sociology and criminal justice at St. Xavier University in Chicago. She is an anti-racist writer, educator, and trainer who is also the author of the amazing book, Birth of a White Nation, The Invention of White People and Its Relevance Today. Welcome back, Doc.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Philippe. Always an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Well, today we're going to be talking about the word that I always get wrong and can't pronounce correctly, anti-miscegenation. I've heard this word from you. I learned this word from you. I learned this term from you in many of our live video shows, as well as, of course, devouring your book and your work and your writings. And I said, you know, maybe we should do a show on just talking about that. And so here we are. To talk about anti-miscegenation. What is anti-miscegenation? And then let's get deeper into, you know, how this word, this term, has shaped America as we know it today.
Certainly. Well, anti-miscegenation references a body of law, and these were laws that made it illegal. They were passed on a state-by-state basis in the United States, and they, in their essence, made it illegal for white people to marry various versions of non-white people. Every anti-miscegenation law ever passed in this country prohibited a white person from marrying a person of African descent, every one of them. But some of them also prohibited a white person from marrying a variety of racialized others, if I can refer to folks in that way. Like tribal people, American Indians, Chinese, and then the language became Mongoloid and Pacific Islander. So it depends on the numbers of racialized others within a particular state.
Okay.
If there were significant numbers, then they would get added to the anti-miscegenation law, the law that made it illegal for white people to marry, generally speaking, a non-white person.
So what was the purpose and the point of that? I mean, okay, we understand what the function of this law did, but of course the question would be, why?
Well, let me go back to the law that I would call perhaps the precursor to anti-miscegenation law. And this is a law that was developed in colonial North America, and comes out of the colony of Maryland. In 1664, Maryland, the colony of Maryland, created a law that punished, and this is the language of the law, British and other freeborn women who married enslaved Negro men. So that's the language of that law. And so this law of 1664 was amended in 1681, and it was in this amendment in 1681 that we see for the very first time in the legal record a reference to a group of humanity called white people. And so anti-miscegenation law is absolutely fundamentally critical for us to understand and explore as a matter of just understanding U.S. history, because it has been central in shaping this country, literally what we look like today. Anti-miscegenation law has lasted over 300 years on the land that became the United States. First developed in 1664, modified in 1681 to then encompass white women. And then it was valid law until 1967 in the famous case Loving versus Virginia. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed itself and held that under the 14th Amendment, it violated the Loving's fundamental rights.
So how has these anti-miscegenation laws shaped America and the generations? Because 300 years, that's a long time. And 300 years, these laws, if not created, ushered in or made it almost logically possible for chattel slavery.
Well, they played a role in that they worked to render whiteness something of value. They worked to give value to it, to promote the idea of white purity, and also to protect and preserve it, this idea called white purity.
Mm-hmm.
So it was used, anti-miscegenation law was used as a free that men with those statuses held the same privileges and rights as a matter of law. And so that changed after Bacon's Rebellion, because the British ruling elite were extremely threatened by this this rebellion, which was enormous. And so their response to it was to divide and conquer the laborers, to ensure that they could never be united in that way and pose such a threat to them. So it is after that rebellion in the 1670s that we see the, first of all, the invention of white people in law, and this invention of white people used to divide the masses of laborers, to give very different meaning to their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that persons of African descent and persons of European descent, if they, again, shared a status as free, had the same rights and opportunities within society. And after Bacon's rebellions, with the imposition of white people by virtue of lots of laws, we see that that changed dramatically, that persons of African descent and members of native tribes formed a new bottom of society, and that was assigned exclusively to them. So even the most depraved white person now would never be as low in society as a person of African descent or a member of a native tribe.
Well, I remember reading a great book called White Trash by Nancy Eisenberg, in which she was talking about the life expectancy of a poor white. I mean, these people were really, really at the bottom of the – they had no motivation, no aspiration, and the life expectancy was like 35, which is absolutely insane. And here you now have they are also slaves, because that was, at the time, that was, tobacco was the, the economy of the land. And so you had blacks, white, I shouldn't say whites, you had Africans and Europeans working side by side, both poor and enslaved. But then I'm sure there were wealthy Africans that had white slaves and black slaves as well. And so
there
were, and so it was just a basic system of this working in this new country that was stolen and taken. We could talk about that. So we're looking at something where these the men of the 1% had a lot of insecurity, based upon, one, how they came to get this country, to steal this country, and the killing and the maiming that it took to do that. And then Bacon's Rebellion shattered their confidence yet again.
Absolutely.
So go ahead. Yeah, this is fascinating.
Well, I was just going to say, one of the things that's also so important to this piece of law, or at least its invention, of anti-miscegenation law, because it seems like I use that word a lot, invention, but it just happens that, most of the laws that were adopted in this country are simply a replica of British common law. So anytime you see a break from that, it tells us something really important about the needs and desires of those who exerted power. And whenever it differs from British common law. So
common law, yeah.
Anti-miscegenation law was not derived from British common law. It was a body of law invented by the British, but in the context of colonial North America. And so when you think about some of the pressures and opportunities that arose in that context, probably the most important piece of historical information is that there was roughly 10 to 12 men for every single woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that is a huge gender imbalance. And we also know that prior to the moment when that first law of 1664 was passed, that it was not uncommon for a British or European woman to marry a man of African descent, whether enslaved or free.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when these white British men were living in a context where there's very few women, and then watching some of them select a non-British man, particularly
sure.
a non-British
and
man
they brought,
of African descent.
They brought women over on ships because it was such a it was so disparaging. It was like, hey, there's just no women here. They literally brought women from England on ships to help populate and I guess balance out that ratio, and it still didn't work.
That's correct. And so they the emergence of anti-miscegenation law, it starts to make more sense when you remember that gender imbalance.
Well, okay, so now looking at this gender imbalance, but looking at anti-miscegenation laws, let's look at some of those laws. Now, you know, one of them, there was a cluster of them that came out over a period of time. We can talk about that if you should so choose to do so. But there, I remember you telling me there were three major aspects of these laws that created what we call in our community the Black Holocaust. And that was, one, a person of African descent could not vote. And someone would say, okay, well, you know, okay, that's great. I can't vote, so I can't really be a part of the shaping of policy in the country and politicians. Okay, that's really messed up, but, you know, it's not the end of the world. Then a person of African descent could not own guns or gunpowder. Oh, hell, wait a minute now. Okay. Now I am completely vulnerable. I cannot protect my family or myself. And then thirdly, as a person of African descent, I cannot sue this new designation of humanity called a white person. So now I have no legal recourse whatsoever. I can be killed, raped, maimed. My family can be killed, raped, maimed. My kids can be killed, raped, maimed. And I have no recourse whatsoever. I am basically...
You are prohibited from testifying against
right.
the white person.
Right. I am a hostage at this point in this country person of African descent. How am I doing, Doc?
You have hit the key laws that were passed after Bacon's Rebellion that were used to do exactly what the lawmakers said they intended to do, which is divide and conquer. It's that body of law that guaranteed, because here's the thing that most of us have a hard time with. We have to remember that prior to the passage of those bodies of laws, prior to that, a free man of African descent could vote, and they did, could own slaves from Africa or indentured servants from Europe, and they did. They could marry a person of the opposite sex regardless of her ethnicity, and they did. So, and they could testify against British or other Europeans, and they did. So, and they could run for public office, although I can't find in the historical record one who did that, but we know mm-hmm. as a matter of law, they certainly could.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have to understand the emergence of these laws within that context, because most of us in our K-12 learnings of U.S. history have no clue that colonial society on the land that became the United States ever had that shape to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A shape where free men of African descent had the same privileges and rights as a matter of law as a British man did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the body of laws that you referenced right now ensured that social structure The one of relative equality by virtue of class standing for a person of African descent or European descent would never exist again.
That is, you know, when you hear it, being on the other side of that history where we are now in the world, it's almost like a novel, you know, or something. It's like that could never happen. That nobody, you know, humans don't do that to each other.
Right.
Yeah. So when you think of this insidious, it's like, you know, it's like these laws were designed based on psychopathy. It's like, okay, here's a psychopathic group of 1% men who, regardless of human life, humanity, we are going to make sure and ensure that we are protected and our wealth is protected and our status is protected and that we have access to all of the things that we want, which are the women and the wealth. And we you know, hey, we had to come here and rape and pillage and steal the country and from the people that were already here anyway. So, you know, we've gotten pretty good at this kind of thing. So who cares? You know, this is the way it's going to be. Then one would say, well, okay, how in the hell do you implement something like this? Because for however long these colonies were in place prior to these anti-miscegenation laws, 1681, everybody was equal. So now Monday.
Within classes.
Yeah, within classes. Now, Monday you go to work. Yeah, class and genders. Now, Monday you go to work and everything is different.
Well, that's right. And
how do you institute that?
Absolutely. Well, that's a great question. And we know that for most people, they learned the message of these new laws by virtue of the new structure imposed on their work site, which for most people was agricultural or and specifically plantation, tobacco plantation in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So the new structure of the plantation reflected the new laws. So that's number one. That's how the vast majority of people learned the new social order. Let's put it mm-hmm. that way. But just in case someone didn't get it via that or some other means, these laws, this body of law passed after Bacon's Rebellion, was required to be read 2 times a year at church on Sunday and the courthouse steps.
Mm. Twice a year on the church house steps. So
at church, both at church and the courthouse steps.
The
so 2 times
steps.
A year, it occurred at both places, yes. It was required by law. There's a specific law that requires that.
So what were the penalties of breaking these anti-miscegenation laws? Obviously, you had people who were in love. Obviously, you had people who were in business together. What happened when you broke this law of anti-miscegenation? What was the penalty to this new designation of white people?
Right. Well, this first law of 1664 that punished freeborn British women who married an enslaved Negro man, this was the punishment. She was enslaved for the duration of her husband's life. Any children that they have were enslaved into their 20s. So you can imagine, and I should say this as well, that in the explanation for that Maryland law of 1664, the lawmakers expressed that the purpose for enacting this law was to, quote, discourage these shameful matches, unquote. And they also reveal in their explanation for the law that it said a couple things that are really important. One is that they viewed these women as forgetful of their rightful status as British and as deserving of rights and freedoms from which others can be denied.
Mm.
So a lot is revealed in their explanation for this law.
We don't want to blame.
But what happened?
I mean, damn it! It looks like the British is yet again the culprit.
Yeah, but again, the British in the context of colonial North America, because the British outside of that context found many of the things done in the context of colonial North America really, frankly, bizarre to them. Like when lawmakers in this nation, the British lawmakers here began to divide people by the color of their skin, that was completely foreign to the British in the mainland. So very much, it we always have to remember, I caution people about blaming the damn British. And we can blame the damn British, but it is the damn British in the context of colonial North America.
Yeah,
so
let's
a couple of things
blame the damn
to say.
The British. No, I'm just kidding.
So, ultimately, the damn British gave their stamp of approval. So I guess
yeah,
maybe that's
you're
okay.
You're complicit in
yeah.
this. I mean, it's like, come on, you know, that's not mince words here. But okay,
right,
so go ahead, Doc.
Well, so here's you think about that punishment, and that women, European women, continued even despite those consequences to engage in these marriages.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, even though the lawmaker said the reason for the law was to discourage these marriages, imagine that you are a large landholder in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, what are the consequences of having such a marriage occur between one of your indentured servants, let's say, and an enslaved man of African descent? Well, it seems only a good thing for you, right? Your property value goes up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you've just acquired a new enslaved person, this one of British descent or European
mm-hmm.
descent,
mm-hmm.
and any children that they have, you know, hey, your economic wealth just went up and up. So what in fact happened after the law of 1664 was that these marriages were encouraged, not discouraged. And so it wasn't until 1681 that the Maryland lawmakers sought to amend the law, and this time they were more effective in light of their expressed purpose for the original law of 1664, which is to deter the marriages. This time they imposed a penalty upon anyone who performs the marriage, whether a religious person or actor of the colony. And so that one was far more successful in deterring them. And it also punished anybody who could be shown to have encouraged the marriage. So
these insecure men of the 1% were threatened at two levels, basically. And that was at the wealth level with Bacon's Rebellion. But they were also threatened at a sexual
masculinity,
level.
Masculinity, absolutely.
The masculinity level. So those were the two drivers. Wow, and you know, we're talking about emotional quotient and emotional intelligence. Wow, we're talking about a psychopathic, insecure group of men, who, when you look at these laws, and you see how they manifest today, you can now, as a result of understanding anti-miscegenation, you can see the cause and effect. I think what we've been doing is looking at all the effects of the effects and not looking at the cause, right? So it's like, how do you can't do that, because that's you're spinning your wheels. It's like, well, we need to march. Well, march for what? Because it's like you're not changing laws. You're not addressing what the country was founded on, and mind you, the anti-miscegenation laws or miscegenation laws, these were laws that were in place before the first meeting of Congress and before the Constitution was written.
Exactly right.
So, you know, wow, what precedes, most people don't even have a concept of what happened before the Constitution. They're just fighting for the Constitution. Well, what fueled and influenced and what was in place prior to the Constitution, these laws?
That's exactly right. Well, and so look, so when we consider a couple things. First of all, we know that upon landing on the shores of North America, that Europeans had no issues with slaughtering, enslaving tribal people.
Mm-hmm.
No issue whatsoever, stealing their land, stealing their resources. And so that certainly didn't stop. So we have that as a backdrop. Then we have from the roughly 1614 until the last two decades of the 17th century, so throughout most of the 1600s, there was a context in the British colonies of persons of African descent who were free and persons of British descent who were free, free of indenture in the former, free of enslavement in the latter, who had the same rights and privileges as a matter of law. So we have these two things going to hold up at the same time as we understand this history. And we also have this amazing gender imbalance at the time. And so when you fold all these together and the threat of that Bacon's Rebellion posed, we see that that the laws that reshuffled that second layer, the colonial society that concerned freedmen of African or European descent,
mm-hmm.
the body of laws enacted after Bacon's Rebellion completely reshuffled that. And so now we have a new, much lower bottom to society, and persons of African descent and tribal people tossed to that location. But let's look at the role of anti-miscegenation law in that process, because I think this is particularly important. Part of what when I'm teaching about those the package of laws that were passed after Bacon's Rebellion that worked to reshape colonial society, one of the things students often want to do is view anti-miscegenation law as something that was prohibiting white people, because it did make it punished white people mm-hmm. who engaged in these marriages, especially when you read just the law on its face. But here's what we know, and we know this largely from studies during the antebellum period of court records and diaries. Laura Edwards, these are all historians, Laura Edwards, Cynthia Bynum, Peter Bardaglio. Their research, I believe all three have written a book, separately written books. These scholars reveal to us in their research that anti-miscegenation law, even though on its face, when you just read the law itself, it looks like it is a prohibition on both white men and white women, and of course upon non-white women and non-white men who want to marry white people.
Mm-hmm.
But when you fold in enforcement practices, that's not at all how this law works. When you fold in enforcement practices, what we see is that there were plenty of examples of white men who were violating anti-miscegenation law.
Mm-hmm.
However, so the question becomes, well, why weren't they brought to trial and prosecuted under anti-miscegenation mm-hmm. law like any white woman and non-white man who violated the law were?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what we find in the record, is this law was almost exclusively enforced against white women and non-white men, and very rarely was it enforced against white men and their non-white partner who violated the law.
Wow.
Yes. So we see, here's the core of that then. So then the purpose of anti-miscegenation law was not only to make white women exclusively available to white men, but also in practice to make all women available to white men.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see that this law, this anti-miscegenation law, worked to centralize patriarchal power among and within white men. And as further evidence of that fact, we can return to one of the laws that you referenced that was passed in that bundle of laws after Bacon's Rebellion that prohibited free black men from being in possession of a gun or powder. And when you think about that law, I think your response was, my God, I'm a, everything a threat. I can't protect my spouse, my children, myself. And that's exactly the case. That law worked to strip black men of patriarchal power, because patriarchal power is derived from the law of coverture, and the law of coverture provides that in marriage, the man and the woman become one, and as a matter of law, the one is the man. And in exchange for that trade, a woman handing over quite literally her legal standing, women were prohibited from having a claim to their own income. Mm-hmm. They couldn't pursue a claim in a court of law. They couldn't create their own trust or will. So quite literally, a woman had zero legal standing. Now, the trade-off was that in exchange, she was to be provided and protected. So that's the law. That's sort of the arrangement of the law of coverture, and out of which patriarchal power is derived. And so when free black men were deprived of the ability to be in possession of a gun or powder, they were essentially stripped of their ability to obtain patriarchal power, because they were not in a position to do what was required in that exchange to protect and provide.
Absolutely amazing. How heinous this is, because this is why when we look at, the slavery narrative in time, you strip a man from being a man, because guns and gunpowder, based upon how this country was taken, is really the, it was almost like, a fingerprint. You had to have gunpowder and firearms. And isn't it interesting that, now white America is so afraid of, of having their guns taken away, or even just a modification of the law, because, when you take that away from a man, he becomes you can see the language too in slavery. He becomes a boy. He's a child. He becomes, he's treated like a child. Because he can't.
He needs protected. Yeah.
He needs
right.
He needs protection.
That's
right. And so we can see how, and mind you, now this is these laws, once they were instituted, it took generations of social evolution and socializing for each generation to be born into these established laws that ushered in chattel slavery, that then ushered in this false sense of success and privilege called whiteness that we're still dealing with today.
Absolutely. I mean, here's a few more just historical things to throw out there, and that is that every moment in U.S. history when the invented white people face a threat to them, I should say, of potential equality with persons of African descent. It is those historical moments when you see a significant upturn in the passage of anti-miscegenation laws. So after the Civil War, passing anti-miscegenation laws, there was a huge burst in states passing these laws. Just as an example. And furthermore, during the civil rights era in the 50s and 60s, public opinion revealed that for persons of African descent, changing anti-miscegenation law was like one of the lowest things on their list of things they cared about. Because, of course, the top things were just basic safety and security and access to employment so people could make their way in the world. Those were among the top for persons of African descent. But for persons of European descent, anti-miscegenation, enforcing and preserving anti-miscegenation law was number one.
Here's the thing, Dr. Battalore, that your work has revealed, and not just your work, but there's other, I think is it Edgar Morgan and what's his name, Allen?
Theodore Allen, yes.
Theodore Allen. However, your particular work because, you know, Alan and Morgan, there were certain aspects that were missed, and the dots didn't automatically connect as it does with the work that you have done. And I remember you telling me the story when you said, hey, where did all the white people go? We'll tell that story in another show of how you came about this information. But, you know, what's fascinating about this is there's no, you know, when we look at the children, teaching children about American history, what we're looking at is there is no happy ending. There is no, quote unquote, good America. And I think that terrifies white people, white parents, to have their children learn the truth about this humanity, this naming of humanity that they're part of. What does it mean to be white? This is what it means to be white. This is what your ancestors did.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good look. It's not a good, there's no place in any of this story, of this history, where you get to feel good. So here's the interesting part. The brain is constantly trying to set a moral compass. When it can't set a moral compass, it has what's known as cognitive dissonance.
That's exactly right.
And so as a result of that, you have to now justify why you are treating another human being in this fashion, or why you are engaging in this behavior, why you are watching this behavior, why are you complicit in this behavior. And so you have to set up a series, not just of laws, but you have to set up a series of systems and subsystems in order to qualify and quantify this cognitive dissonance. And you've
and
even
fundamental.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And
go
fundamental
ahead.
And fundamental ideas, right? Because
yeah.
Look at the cognitive dissonance as it played out with regard to Europeans in their treatment of tribal people.
Mm-hmm.
Like what was it? It had to be rationalized, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm a good person. Europeans perceived of themselves as good, good Christians specifically. So do good Christians move into a new land and rape and pillage and take resources? Well, no. But if I view those people as savages and in desperate need of Christianity, I'm actually saving them by being here and
mm-hmm.
stealing their land, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like those are the stories, the way in which cognitive dissonance has manifested on the part of Europeans since arriving in North America. And so for persons of African descent, that emerged soon after the invention of white people, when you see even built into that package of laws that you cited, messages about persons of African descent and messages about this new group of people called white people.
Mm-hmm.
And what those laws make clear is that persons of African descent are a threat, not to be trusted with any sort of weaponry, are less than other citizens or citizens to be. And conversely, the message is that white people, no matter how they behave, right, because it's just about whiteness, that anybody who's white is deserving of rights and privileges from which others can be denied, i.e. superior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
so we see how that way,
mm-hmm.
yeah, the way in which the British conceived of themselves just lent itself tragically, beautifully into white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the calling card there. I think the curtains are supposed to close on that one. That's enough for people to absorb and to get. And I'm sure, as I have, there are many people who will be listening to this that will have so many aha moments, because there's so many dots that needed to be connected. And what I love about the work that you've done and the history that you have uncovered and in the manner in which you have uncovered it is that it does. It connects the dots. It's like, oh, man, that's how that happened. Because there's so many things that are disconnected, doesn't make sense, that we just wake up. Because we're all, you know, it's kind of like Debbie Irvin. We're all waking up white. The moment that we're born,
right,
we're waking up white. All, you know, in this country. And so we just assume that these things are normal, and they're not. But then we don't know the questions to ask, or we don't know where to begin to look for the answers. And so we just accept it as it is. And then again, we start trying to fight an effect with another effect.
Hmm. Well,
and we never get to the cause.
If I may say one thing before the end of your show, it would be that it is precisely shows like yours, Philippe Matthews, that offers large numbers of people the opportunity to wake up.
Thank you for that. That's what we see. Thank you for that. Well, obviously, this is going to be an ongoing series, ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Jacqueline Battalora, Birth of a White Nation is the book. I also would like to say, ladies and gentlemen, if you could, for me, go to JacquelineBattalora.com. Or is it Battalora.com?
Are you doing a free e-course?
Yes, the free e-course.
Okay. It's Battalora, Battalora, freeecourse.com.
BattaloraFreeEcourse.com. There is a 5-day e-course in there that's free that really digs deep and gives you an understanding that, you know, so say, hey, I want to be able to explain this to my kids. I want to take this back to the diversity section of my company. I want to talk about this with a coworker. I want to talk to them about this, to some friends and family, or whenever the race thing comes up, I want to be able to speak intelligently about that and to be able to explain why we are the way we are and how we got here. This e-course gives you that language, gives you that context. At the end of that 5-day e-course, you receive an email where you have the opportunity, which is a limited opportunity, but you have the opportunity for only $1 to receive a 47-minute PowerPoint presentation and lecture on everything Birth of a White Nation, everything Invention of White People, and how all of this began, how this began, where it began, where we are today. You could only, and it's only for $1. So this is something that you just have to do. If you're truly serious about learning your history, knowing your history, and knowing American history, go to battalora.com/free course. Free e-course or free course?
It's Battalora, B as in boy, Battalora, freeecourse.com.
Free e-course. Battalora, freeecourse.com. I appreciate you, Doc.
Correct.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you so much. Thanks to your listeners.
All right. We'll see you guys next time. Well, we won't see you on this show because this is all radio. We'll hear you again next time on the Philippe Matthews Radio Show. Take care, everybody.